This episode of The Urbanist was first broadcast on the 14th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck, and you're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, the programme devoted to the cities we live in. In this episode, we navigate the world of urban map-making. How do these types of maps we use affect how we see the world around us? From reading a city's history, solving its current planning problems, or just making our way to dinner. The city we see is the city we've mapped. We'll start with London's iconic tube map, and how a set of design rules laid down in the 1930s are still dictating how we understand this city.
The map is organising central London in a way it doesn't quite match reality. Most of it's not too bad, but it is distorting people's expectations a little bit.
Then it's off to Beirut, where Venetia Rainey takes a look at one of the first proper maps of the city, made by a Danish explorer in the 19th century. What does it teach us about the Lebanese capital today?
This is an original of the Julius.
Yes.
We can see that there's loads of green areas. I mean, the city of Beirut is so much smaller in 1876.
We'll also snap some QR codes from Rio's street corners, speak to Oxford academic Mark Graham about what internet and mobile mapping does to a city, and ask a couple of Swiss planners why understanding a city is best done with 3D models, the real-life kind. All that, plus how new you've got to be a grid, what it's like to navigate a city for which there are no maps whatsoever, and a tall story from entrepreneur and adventurer Justin Packshaw. Stay tuned.
And now, The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck.
Welcome to episode 70 of The Urbanist. Whether you live in London or are just a visitor, your understanding of how the city is stitched together likely has a lot to do with a map of its underground. But since Henry Beck drafted the city's iconic diagram of the Tube City, much has changed. Beck's rules, devised when there are far fewer routes and far less information to convey to commuters, still dictate the map's design. Dr. Max Roberts is a psychologist at the University of Essex and author of Underground Maps Unraveled. Urbanist producer David Michon asked Dr. Roberts about Beck's legacy and how iterations of the Tube map can dramatically change how we understand London's layout.
A long, long time ago, the map was basically geographical. It was designed by someone called Fred Stingmore. And what he did was he preserved the topography of London as much as he could. So everywhere you look, there were sort of bending, twisting lines. Very, very complicated to look at. All sorts of information you don't need. You don't need to know just how much the lines bend around and twist if you just want to get from A to B. Now, what had been happening, though, is on the trains and publicity posters, people had actually been simplifying the routes to make them have a bigger impact from the point of view of publicity. And
so graphic designers who weren't necessarily map experts.
Yes, the graphic designers were simplifying the lines. The cartographers were trying to stick to reality. And when you look at the trains, you can see how things were really being distorted and squashed and stretched and compacted just to fit the maps onto the train panel, where it's very shallow and very wide. And what Henry Beck did was he looked at the simplification, put the pieces together so that he created the first ever network map of London, in which he smoothed out all the curves and just showed the whole thing with just straight lines, 45 degrees, horizontal, vertical.
Cut to today and the tube map, which is an iteration of Henry Beck's original design. But as you've said, you know, in various talks and in writings, that there's information overload, basically.
Yes.
Where now we show connections to other types of transport, whether it's intercity rail or boats, and likewise there's wheelchair accessibility and just all of this cluttering of information. How does that influence the way we interact with this map to get around London?
It makes it less generally accessible. If, you know, when people are faced with information overload and they can't cope with it, then they're more likely to just give up with the map and ask for assistance. A lot of the information has been quite carelessly applied. So, for instance, the wheelchair symbols obliterate the interchange circles. So it's a different piece of information actually compete with each other on the map for attention. And it's not just the quantity of information, you know, physically added to the map, mean, the network's been squashed into a much, it's been squashed into the same size space as in 1933. And there's 100 extra stations on the map compared with Henry Beck when he did his work. And something's got to give. And the current map isn't just overloaded with supplementary information. The actual way in which it shows the network is less effective now than it used to be.
I'm wondering if, you know, speaking generally and not just about London, is there some kind of general logic with which people approach transport maps? What is it that map makers should be trying to access to open up this world to someone who's maybe just visiting London or hasn't lived here for a very long time or isn't a frequent user of the Tube? What will connect them really well with wayfinding, essentially?
Map makers should be trying to present the underlying structure of the network. So in London, we've got a central line forming a horizontal, the northern line a vertical, the Bakerloo line following a similar trajectory. And if we consider the Paris Metro, for instance, which has a very disorganized, very chaotic network with lines that twist and turn all over the place. The problem with this map is that the designer has just applied Beck's rules without thinking about how they can simplify the world. And so if you follow the line 4, for instance, there's 17 bends from end to end. That's not simplified the structure of the line at all or made it clear. It's just taken life's complexity and changed the shape of it. France is a challenge because the lines are really chaotic. They're twisted and tangled together. None of the lines follow a real clear trajectory. So the challenge for the designer is to try and show the network what little structure it's got, try and show it as effectively as possible. And what Paris does have is a nice ring around the periphery of the city centre. And so one of my designs, I'm trying to emphasise that ring. And the interesting thing is that I can show people the map with the ring and it organises the city. It sort of defines the centre a bit. But even though they know the ring is there, when they look at the other map, they still can't see it there. Mm-hmm. So in fact, if you present the network chaotically, then it's not a question of looking for the structure. The structure is just not there to see.
So there's a different structure that applies to different cities, essentially.
Every city's got its own peculiarities, its own organisation. One set of rules that works for one city might not work for another city.
How do you think people's association with this map, who take the Tube to get everywhere in the city, how do you think that distorts how they see the city?
I think it distorts things quite considerably. In the sort of the simplest way, it sort of straightens out the streets, makes Oxford Street look horizontal when it's, in fact it's on a lean. But it actually has a much more sort of deeper effect, which is that people actually lose all track of distances between stations. You know, if you only pop down on a station, then pop up at another station, you get very little feel for London. And so, you know, people actually take the underground for just a couple of stops when they don't really need to, when, you know, walking would be easier. And even sort of longer looking journeys like Liverpool Street to Elephant and Castle, it looks like a long journey on the map, but actually, you know, if you walk fast enough, you can beat the buses following the road. The map is organising central London in a way it doesn't quite match reality. Most of it's not too bad, but it is distorting people's expectations a little bit. But by expanding the centre, it's making it look as though places in central London are much more distant than they otherwise would be.
That was Dr. Max Roberts, psychologist at the University of Essex. Next up, more map history. What does Beirut's first map say about the city today? Who gave New York its grid? And was it a good thing? And why a pair of Swiss planners think a relief can help resolve your planning problems? You're listening to the Urbanist Special on Maps and Navigation. Although small, Beirut is a city that has developed at unchecked speed following the blanket destruction of Lebanon's capital during its 15-year civil war. Green spaces in particular are now almost non-existent. It wasn't always so, however, as Venetia Rainer discovers when she takes a trip to the Danish embassy in the city for a look at one of the first maps of the Lebanese capital.
Beirut, city of endless traffic jams. Every day, rain, rush hour, or plain old reckless driving leaves the city's arteries clogged with cars trying to navigate the maze of alleyways, one-way roads, and building sites. Less than 150 years ago, Beirut was a completely different place. But aside from fading photographs and written accounts, there are very few surviving testimonies to this fact. There is one particularly notable exception. Escaping the chaos of downtown, I went to the peaceful and heavily guarded inner sanctuary of Beirut's parliament and embassy complex. I wanted to talk to Denmark's ambassador to Lebanon, Jan Top Christensen, about a map drawn by Julius Leutford, the 19th century Danish consul in what was then Syria. On the wall of Jan's office was a copy of the original map, a roughly A3 sized sheet of paper. Drawn with stupendous attention to detail, the web of black, inky lines on a yellowing parchment showed a Beirut I barely recognised.
Here you have the Le Grand Serail, so we are approximately here. And this is West Beirut.
And it's all green, there's no development.
Yeah, I mean, have a look.
Yeah.
What a chance they have had to develop the land and make parks and whatever. Somewhere here you would have Hamra Street, right? I mean, this is just the open land, countryside, and it's only the center. I mean, we have downtown here next to Le Grand Serail, which is already there, right, with the streets and the buildings. And then north, it's countryside, and west, south, it's countryside. So it has developed a lot.
And is this a mountain?
Yeah, I mean, you don't have the feeling really today, but there is actually, I mean, in French they talked about collines de sable, dunes, sand dunes, right? And I mean, you wouldn't know that when you drive around in the area, but you have, I mean, the feeling if you come from here and go to Verdun, for example, you go uphill, you really feel it. So the interesting thing is that was sand, because other parts of Lebanon is rock. And this was done in 1876. And this is the name of this Danish consul, Julius Leutved.
Did he create this map of his own accord, or was he commissioned to by...
No, I think I have seen no indication that was something he was commissioned to do. I think he did that out of own interest.
Would he have drawn this himself, or would he have gone around collecting the
data? He must have had some people helping him, because with all these details, I mean, and the very fine... delicate details you see around what was Beirut at that time. He wouldn't have been able to do that himself. He needed some people to help him doing the measuring, correct measuring. Because it seems when I look at these things, the dimension seems to be correct. So it's not just something he has just thrown on the map like that. To me, it looks as a professional map.
As he points to various intricate details, Jan tells me it is the oldest map he has ever seen of Beirut and was drawn up while the region was under the Ottoman rule of Sultan Abdul Hamid II.
It's interesting to have, and when I came down, I found out, I didn't know it before, that there was this Danish consul that was here, had been here for a number of years, and very busy man. He was, as you can see here, also he was intendant of the school, Anglo-Syrian schools. And that's also an interesting historic part of it, right? Anglo-Syrian. Today we talk about this is Lebanon. And this gentleman is interesting, apart from being the Danish consul at that time and the intendant at the school. He also was very busy traveling in the region, because he was buying up for a famous Dane, the founder of Carlsberg Brewery. And if you go to Copenhagen today, you find one of the best collections of Mediterranean and Middle East art.
The framed copy of the map that now hangs in Jan's office was given to him as a present from the company that reconstructed Beirut's flattened downtown area, Solidaire. The original, however, is a mere 10-minute drive away in the city's other large oasis of calm, the spacious, tree-lined American University of Beirut compound. I descended into the hush-hush archives of AUB's Jaffet Memorial Library to try and find it. Nestled in a single, half-full drawer of much larger maps of Beirut, Leutford's creased contribution to the city's cartography still had the most character. Nadine Knesevich, an assistant there, agreed to show it to me.
This is an original of the Julius
Leutford
map. And we can see that there's loads of green areas. I mean, the city of Beirut is so much smaller in 1876.
Mm-hmm. It was empty here. It's not like nowadays, how they have developed the greenery, the new streets, the what is now called the central district of Solidaire and whatever. No, we're talking ages ago here about this one. Yeah, it's like when you see Beirut, the pictures of Beirut, you had the cactus and an empty.
Several of the maps she showed me were drawn in the 1950s, and then... A long silence until the 90s, when full-colour touristic maps suddenly start to become part of the collection. Beirut's layout during this period, which would have changed rapidly with the advent of concrete high-rise apartment blocks and a string of civil wars, remains unmapped, at least officially. Thankfully, new maps of the city have been produced in the last 20 years, but in the meantime, development continues apace, further altering Beirut's original face and creating new and unfamiliar realities, even for those who have been here for decades. For all his cartographic skills, if Julius Leutford could come here now, he probably would have got very lost. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Coming up, New York's grid, Swiss reliefs, and the world of mobile mapping. But first, a short break.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Urbanist on Monocle 24 and our episode on maps and navigation. Now to New York. The story of New York's historic grid plan is one we've visited before on The Urbanist. But that of John Randall Jr., the surveyor charged with gridding Manhattan back in 1808, and the subject of a forthcoming biography, is a new story for us. Randall was an accomplished cartographer, surveyor, and inventor, a prolific, flamboyant man with broad vision of what the city would become. And while Randall's legacy is less secure than New York's urbanists such as Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs, aspects of his work have proven just as influential. Monocle's Barrett Austin recently sat down with Marguerite Holloway, author of The Measure of Manhattan, for a conversation about Randall and his contributions to the New York that we know today.
John Randall Jr. was a surveyor and cartographer and inventor. He was born in Albany in 1787, and he became apprenticed at a very young age to Simeon DeWitt, who was the surveyor general for New York State. And Simeon DeWitt brought John Randall down to implement and lay out the grid plan for Manhattan. And John Randall went on to do these incredibly beautiful maps of the city, to work on some of the country's earliest canals and railroads. He designed an early model for the elevated railroad in New York City. He did a lot of very different kinds of things over the course of what was for then an extremely long life.
Looking back in history a couple of hundred years, I think it's really important that we get some sort of vision of what Manhattan was like in 1808 when Randall Jr. was initially commissioned for this. What did it look like in 1808?
It wasn't a wilderness. At that point, it had been settled for several hundred years by Europeans, and it was very rural. There were a lot of farms, a lot of estates. There were a lot of fishermen's camps. There were structures all the way up the island, but it was definitely more rural and green and wild, clearly, than it is today, and much more so than we sort of typically think about when we look around.
What led the city of New York to bring in a surveyor to lay out this grid for the city?
There were three commissioners who were appointed to devise a plan for development for New York City. And as I say, one of them was Simeon DeWitt, the Surveyor General of New York State. And it seems, although the documentation is a little fragmented, it seems that the first surveyors that they worked with in 1807 were not doing a good job. There are some letters in which they bemoan the miserable state of surveying. And I think DeWitt decided to bring in somebody who he felt he could trust and who would be absolutely rigorous and precise about measuring the island, and that person was John Randall Jr.
And when John Randall Jr. was brought in, what was he initially told that he was going to be doing? What did his actual work entail? Because it seems like he was very precise in the work that he did, and he must have seen every square inch of this island. What did the work entail?
He had several stages of work. The first stage was basically walking the island, and as you say, almost every inch, I'm sure, at least up to where 150 Fifth Street is, because that was the northern extent of the grid. And he would measure and then put stakes in the ground, marking out the lines for the streets and for the avenues. And that was sort of the first stage. And then he did three versions of a manuscript map that showed what that grid plan would look like on the island. The second stage was not for the commissioners. He was hired by New York City to then go out and sort of make permanent this grid plan. That entailed remeasuring everything and putting much more permanent markers at intersections. So he would put these big marble monuments, and sometimes if there was a rock, he would put a bolt in a rock. And that was to fix permanently this grid plan that had been sort of more imagination and blueprint before. And then the last stage, he made these 92 remarkable maps of the island at an incredible scale. I think it's 100 feet to an inch. And those basically record every natural feature of the landscape as it was in the early 1800s, from North Street all the way up to the end of the island. They're exquisite maps.
And once his grid was essentially laid out and designed, what did the next steps entail as far as implementation is concerned?
Once the maps were set and the plan was fixed, the city then basically began to open the streets and the avenues. And that sort of opening of streets moved slowly up the island. It reached about 42nd Street by about 1850, and then it proceeded on up the island, with the great exception of Central Park, which was not in the grid plan and was set aside in the late 1850s, 1860s.
Looking back at the era in which John Randall Jr. was working, he was very much sort of a pioneer, at least as far as America is concerned. To what degree would you say that the work that he did and the example that he left with a place like Manhattan helped to inform the way that urban planners and surveyors ended up sort of planning and laying out the rest of this country?
Randall, starting to work in 1808 on this grid plan, was actually sort of inheriting a grid plan, because Simeon DeWitt had used a grid to map out upstate New York before they even got to this plan for Manhattan. And before that, the United States government had decided to use a grid plan to settle a large part of the West. And as many historians of urban planning have pointed out, the grid is perhaps the most common city form throughout history. So Randall, I don't think, really contributed anything that changed city planning as we went forward. He really was very much of an era when the grid was paramount. And if anything, he did contribute to this amazing moment of thinking about infrastructure and thinking about connection and thinking about weaving together this emerging United States by connecting people through canals and railroads.
That was Marguerite Holloway speaking to Monocle's Barrett Austin. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24. Next up in our episode on maps and navigation, why a 3D model that can sit on your desk rather than your computer screen can help you solve your planning problems. Maps, streets, houses, landscapes elegantly painted and printed on huge pages of paper have been around for hundreds of years. Since then, they have set the standard for orientation and spatial planning. Yet 2D maps don't serve their purpose well enough, say two Swiss experts. Mark Engelhardt found out what they mean.
We're on the top floor of Focus Terra, the information center on earth sciences at the Swiss Institute of Technology in Zurich. School classes and students flock to this place to learn more about the space surrounding them. Bettina Gutbrot is with me. She's one of the scientists who accompanies those groups, and she says the possibly biggest hit is the relief of present-day Zurich we're looking at right now. It looks a bit like a landscape from a model railway, but it is much more accurate.
You have every single house in Zurich on this relief. So the first thing every visitor does is look for his own home. There's an immediate connection. Even if you're a visitor, you'd look for the train station you arrived at this morning.
Focus Terra is one of those new museums where you have lots of flashy artifacts, and they even have an earthquake simulator. So you wouldn't expect something like a 3D relief of your hometown to be so popular.
I think it's the most playful way of orienting yourself. You see the lake, the Jertlibirk mountain, and those landmarks help you get the big picture of your hometown, which you don't usually get.
The man who built the relief in Focusterra and many more is Tony Meyer. His house in the Swiss mountains is part exhibition space, part workshop. With his electrical jigsaw, Meyer carefully cuts sheets of plywood on which before he has glued maps.
I have cut out one piece now, which later makes one of the contour lines of a landscape. I will have cut out hundreds of them before I can finish what I call a staircase model, a landscape model where you have a new step every 10 meters or so.
Meyer then uses the staircase model to create a negative of the landscape he will later build from plaster stone. With a variety of knives and other tools, he slowly transforms the steps into a real landscape. Hills and mountains, roads and town squares. Houses and trees are added in the very end on the basis of the very latest maps and aerial 3D photographs Meyer can find. It is strenuous work. Each square meter of a relief takes him about 350 hours, says Meyer, but the former teacher believes it's worth it.
Lots of people can't read maps. That's one of the big problems in planning. But if they have a relief, a model in 3D, then it's much easier for them to see what it could mean if we built some houses here or a road there.
Absolute accuracy is needed, though, to reach this goal, says Meyer. Computers or 3D printers are therefore not an option.
I was asked to produce a cross-section of the Alps once, from Lake Constance to Bergamo. I didn't have the time, so they had it done by computer. Honestly, I wouldn't have slept if I'd have delivered work as shabby as that. There were cut marks everywhere. It just didn't look like the real thing, and then it doesn't serve its purpose.
On a hill overlooking Zurich, Professor Martin Raubal looks at one of the reliefs Meyer produced some years ago. Raubal is an expert on spatial recognition, and he agrees with Meyer on one thing. 2D maps as we know them are not enough.
I like the reliefs. I mean, it's not only artwork, it's a combination of technical work and artwork, and it's kind of amazing how these people can represent the environment in such detail and actually through a manual process.
However, when it comes to practical aspects, the relief for Raubal is destined to be history. The future for Raubal is in computers, which, he says, not only produce constantly better 3D maps, but also offer many practical benefits.
You can use the technology in a dynamic way. That means modern technology in terms of GIS and for planning allows you to actually change scenarios like on the fly and then have people provide their input and make suggestions. And based on these suggestions, you can actually change things. That was not possible with old technology, so to speak.
Public participation GIS, GIS for Geographical Information System, already provides 3D maps on web platforms accessible to everyone.
You build for the public, and so obviously you also want their opinion and their suggestions to influence such a project. And with public participation GIS, you can actually provide 3D GIS on web platforms that people can play around with, and they actually can comment. They can identify hotspots, they can identify buildings that they don't like so much, they can make suggestions where something can be changed. And I think that's one direction that will become more and more prominent in the future.
In Raubal's view, maps have to be changing from picturing reality at a certain point in time to picturing different realities according to the user. But he realizes that using web platforms might even be more challenging to people than the old 2D map.
For example, lots of problems with previous wayfinding services were that they would always give you instructions in terms of, you know, the metric system. So you would get an instruction like walk for 200 meters, then turn right, walk for 20.5 meters and so on. But people do not really think like that. You know, most people in such a scenario would prefer, okay, you see that red building there. At that red building, turn right, go until you see the church. So this is landmark-based wayfinding. And research has demonstrated that people actually have a much easier time with landmark-based reasoning.
Orientation based on landmarks, that's what also Tony Meyer had in mind when he started building reliefs 40 years ago. But that art might be coming to an end for purely biological reasons, says the 78-year-old pensioner.
Ich habe noch keine Nachfolger.
I don't have a successor yet, he says. No one seems to be willing or capable of taking on the hard work he's doing. So it might well be that Tony Meyer will be the last of his kind. Will computers be his true successor? Maybe, maybe not. Even Martin Raubal knows that when it comes to spatial orientation, computers don't solve every problem.
There is this prominent example about wayfinding, that the differences between females and males in wayfinding, and they always say that on average, actually, females are doing better because men always try when they get lost on a map. They still say that, no, I want to do it on my own. I don't need any help. And the women just say, okay, I can find my way. So just going to ask somebody.
For Monocle, in Zurich and Unteregeri, Switzerland, I'm Mark Engelhardt.
Time for a short break in this episode about the future of mapping and navigation. And surprise, it's all about your mobile phone. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
You're listening to The Urbanist here on Monocle 24. This episode, we're talking about maps and navigation. For anyone who's been to Rio de Janeiro, one romantic image tends to stand out. The swirling black and white mosaic-tiled sidewalks lining Copacabana Beach and dotted throughout other parts of the city. Now, Rio has decided to add a technological twist to these tiles. Scattered around the city, 30 black and white quick response barcodes, better known as Q or QR codes, are being embedded into these tiles. Take a picture of these Q codes with your smartphone or tablet, and you'll get information about the site and a map telling you where you are. But what's so hard about just asking a passerby for directions? Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter went to the city of Samba to see if these Q codes are taking to Rio's rhythm.
Sounds of samba float through the streets and pound the pavement in Rio de Janeiro's South Zone as crowds pack into the sweltering hot streets for the city's famous annual carnival celebrations. Around 1 million tourists are expected to flood the city this carnival season, many of them foreigners who don't speak Portuguese. So as the city gains more international exposure, Rio City Hall has adapted. This weekend, the city inaugurated its second Q code in the Portuguese-tiled sidewalks at the Sambadrome, where the world-famous two-day carnival parade has been taking place. Sabrina Neto, coordinator of the QR Rio project from communication company Grupo Máquina, explains how the Q codes work in the city.
A pessoa chega, digitaliza o código, ele vai te jogar para uma página na internet, um site que você vai abrir.
The person gets there and takes a picture of the Q code. You have to download an app that can read Q codes, which will then take you to a web page. There you have the option to get information in English, Spanish, and Portuguese. The first language that opens is Portuguese, with a photo of the area you're in. It gives you information like where you are, site-specific details, local information, the cultural significance of the area, and anything unique and interesting.
Wedged between the two iconic neighborhoods of Copacabana and Ipanema, vicious waves beat up against the rocks at Arpoador. This was the first Q code location, opening up at the end of January. But Arpoador and the Sambadrome locations are just the start. By the end of this year, Rio will have a total of 30 Q codes at famous sites like Sugarloaf Mountain and the upscale neighborhood of Leblon. After that, the city map section of the project will be developed even further. Sabrina Neto again.
Nessa primeira etapa, a gente disponibiliza map apenas para pessoas se localizar dentro de onde ela está.
During this first stage, we had a map to show people where they were. But during the second step of the project, we're expecting to put in Google Maps, Locators, Foursquare, a series of different apps and options that are going to help people get around the city.
The installation of these new Q-codes with maps and information seems like a logical next step for this bustling emerging market city. Technology is booming in Brazil, and mobile internet isn't just something for the elite anymore, says Fabrícia Rosa, director of Grupo Máquina in Rio de Janeiro.
Today, mobile technology is very democratic. Every socioeconomic class in Brazil has a mobile phone with internet access. So why not bring this democratic technology to certain points of the city? Research shows that people have up to 2 mobiles no matter what their income is. They just have to download an app to their phone, and then they can access the information.
And as the city gears up to host the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Summer Olympics, tourism in Rio is expected to boom, leaving a greater demand for this kind of service. Fabrícia Rosa, again.
It's much more than just giving you information. It's providing you with a service as well. We think that the city deserves it. The city is in a really good moment. We're going to have the World Cup and the Olympics. So it's time to share this love and knowledge of Rio to the tourists, and for those who live here too.
Back over at Arpoador, I go to check out to see how much this first Q-code is being used, after it reportedly got 2,000 unique users within the first 5 days it was installed. The number of users is expected to skyrocket during Carnival. I search for about 20 minutes looking for it, and no luck. But after I flash a photo of the Q-code to a local lifeguard, we did a little detective work to find the Q-code. And it was found, conveniently located, underneath a temporary Carnival porta-potty. Aside from the difficulty to locate the Arpoador Q-code, some tourists here would like to try out this new map and information technology. Diana Tolfer from Chicago, Illinois, is having a relaxing afternoon on Devil's Beach by Arpoador. She didn't know about the new technology being installed in Rio sidewalks, but she would like to test them out.
I will try it, but only during daytime, probably not later at night, because I'll miss them, I won't see them.
The problem is, though, her mobile network doesn't work in Brazil, meaning no access to 3G. She tells me what type of technology they are using to try to get around the city.
Wi-Fi on the phone, wherever there is Wi-Fi, it's very spotty and everything is actually locked. But we have been able to find Wi-Fi on the other side of the beach.
What about 3G or anything?
Have not used it.
3G internet is easily accessible by any Brazilian who has set up a phone contract or who has a prepaid phone chip. But how difficult is it for a foreigner to get access to this 3G network?
It's massively difficult.
That's Owen Murphy. He's originally from Ireland, but has been calling Rio home for the past 3 months. Owen knows more about the ways of Brazil than your average gringo. He explains that in order to buy a pay-as-you-go mobile chip for an unlocked phone, it's not easy. It's a must to have a taxpayer number, better known as a CPF number, in order to get a phone contract or to even get a pay-as-you-go chip. He says that if free Wi-Fi is more easily available, only then are they likely to be used by tourists.
I think it's a novel idea, but the uptake in the UK even of Q-codes, as they're called, is minimal. And in Brazil, with the overcharged roaming, it's just not a runner. I think the only way to get them engaged is free Wi-Fi spots with the Q-codes, but otherwise it's a non-runner.
And whether these Q-codes will take off in Rio de Janeiro or not, it's certain that there will still be plenty of samba and smiles to go around. And with the friendly nature of Brazilians, you don't have to worry about the battery life of your mobile to just ask. The old-fashioned way of speaking to strangers helps people not only learn how to get from A to B, but about the people they pass on the street and the culture of a neighborhood. So it's likely that asking for directions to navigate through the city will still be the most popular way to get around Rio. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Mobile technology is seen by many as the future of mapping. And aiming your phone at a street corner certainly changes how you see a city, compared to keeping your chin up and just looking around. it begs the question of how mobile mapping skews the way we interact with cities, and whether, at some point, it may cause us to also rethink how we plan those cities. Urbanist producer David Michon rang up the director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute, Dr. Mark Graham, to find out.
One of the most interesting parts of this is that we're moving away from any sort of staticness in the map, so that the map that you look at is different from the map that I look at, and the map that I look at now is different from the map that I looked at yesterday. And often these maps that we essentially enact or create, they're not reproducible in any way, because if we're using something like Google Maps, to use your example, to get information about a restaurant, then Google is using all sorts of cues to tailor the map to us. So whether we're logged in, what time of day it is, where it thinks we are, what information it already has about us, what language we're using to search in, all of these factors influence what geospatial information is essentially thrown at us or used to populate the very customized map that's being created. And so this obviously is often extremely useful to people, because you're getting what Google thinks you're looking for, but it also makes life kind of hard for people like me, for people trying to study this stuff and to understand what's being created and what's not being created, because there's no definitive map that's out there. There are millions and millions of maps that are just constantly being brought into being, and then they evaporate the minute that you're finished with them.
In studying the history of cities, obviously, one of the things we would look at is historic maps of places. That's going to become increasingly difficult as these maps, as you mentioned, become more and more ephemeral. How do you think this will influence the way we come to understand or look at cities from a historical perspective? You know, looking back on 2013, you know, in 2023, it will be a lot more difficult to understand, you know, the fabric of the city, or will it?
This is probably something people have not thought about enough. I've spoken with people at Google about, you know, I've given them examples of things that happen if you search for a certain keyword about a certain place, and they haven't been able to reproduce what I told them, simply because, you know, their systems aren't set up to do this. So if Google themselves can't go back in time, essentially, and reproduce certain maps, then it's going to be very hard for anyone else to create what might be a meaningful historical record of any of this. And I don't really know what the solution is, because it's not as if you can really create a sort of meaningful singular history of digital cartography in the sense that we're talking about here, simply because it is so customized and individualized. It's hard to even imagine what we should and shouldn't be storing in this sense.
But of course, within London, of course, you know, if you're asking your Google Maps for a restaurant recommendation that's near Baker Street Tube Station, it will give you, you know, the restaurants that are listed in Google that have websites that have, you know, information about them, you know, provided by various other users of the internet. So there's this kind of digital divide within the city, which exists kind of in its useful form in maps. Do you see that happening? Do you think there is a digital divide within cities, and what influence do you think that has kind of on the shape of the high street, for instance?
Yes, there's undoubtedly a digital divide in the sense that some places are simply represented and some places aren't. Some places are just left off the map entirely, and therefore, if we're using a map or a digital map to try and find somewhere to eat, for instance, we just won't stumble across these places unless we actually physically stumble across them. But I think we probably will also start to see what we might call digital divides in terms of between places that are online. So increasingly, we're going to increasingly see most businesses get some sort of digital representation and be in some way represented on a map. But that doesn't mean we have unlimited attention to discover these places. So if you're searching for pizza in London, you're going to be given, if we're using Google Maps, the top 10 results on your first page that Google thinks are relevant to your search based on where you are and what language you're searching in, etc. Research shows that very few people are willing to click beyond that first page. So if you're not in that immediately visible group of search results, you don't really exist in the city. You become invisible to most people.
That was Dr. Mark Graham of the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University, speaking to Urbanist producer David Michon. Maps are often something that we take for granted. In the cities that we've visited in this episode, maps are a standard way of navigating. But what about those places where maps, printed or digital, aren't really an option? For this week's monologue, Monocle senior editor Sophie Grove explores what happens in a mapless city.
Decent maps are something we often take for granted. Despite the fact that many of us couldn't orientate our way to the end of our own back gardens using a compass and Ordnance Survey map, we make routine use of the endeavours of those diligent government cartographers who have named and recorded our streets. Yet in large swathes of much of the world, the urban and suburban sprawl is uncharted territory. Streets are not named, and roads are often unpaved and evolving. This can pose a considerable hurdle for a foreign correspondent. Take, for instance, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's mountainous capital, where 82% of the population live in unplanned neighbourhoods, and where the government hasn't got round to naming some of the city's crucial roads, let alone its informal ones. I often travel to Addis on assignment for Monocle, and have spent many long hours en route to rendezvous, interviews, and restaurants, following complicated directions, but with no actual address. Why would you have an address if your road has no name and your house has no number? I remember one frustrated afternoon with a local driver trying to find a local architect's office for an interview about urban development. Our directions read like an endless I spy of innocuous local landmarks. You'll see a garage, a water cellar, then a blue bin, our would-be host told me on the phone. This is not unusual. Scenes like this have repeated themselves in Maputo, Accra and beyond. On a recent trip to the beautiful area of Ashrafi in Lebanon, I was told by my hotel there's really no such thing as an address in Lebanon, just landmarks. My artful colonial era pension turned out to be a devil to find for a newbie. Near a church, not far from that half-built tower, and near the taxi rank, said my hosts. But now we return to Addis, where a few years ago I met a man who had set about trying to record the urban fabric of the Ethiopian capital with Teutonic efficiency. At the huge tiled modernist edifice of City Hall, built by the former ruler Haile Selassie, I met the German architect Michael Maywald, who was embedded with the city authorities as part of a GTZ initiative to map the city. His epic cartographic mission involved the use of several very old computers, a complex mapping database, and 28 surveyors who were sweeping the city, recording each plot and some 3,000 streets. There was no real system of addressing in Addis, he told me. It's a problem, he told me. Ambulances frequently get lost. At this stage, his work was 1 terabyte large, the size of a truck battery. But the sheer volume of his task wasn't the only obstacle. Maywald was also trying to convince his City Hall colleagues to name the city's streets and signpost them. Selling the merits of a signpost for every alley, dirt road or new street was far from easy, he told me. Why bother when the current system was working just fine? And there were political issues to contend with too, because naming streets can be controversial. This was really a discussion for not months, but years, he sighed, showing me endless charts and grids in his airless office. Maywald had put forward the idea of using famous Africans as inspiration, or flora and fauna, but no one could agree which statesmen and which flowers. At the time, the only signposting consensus had been the 53 countries currently in the African Union. I'm not sure where Maywald's project got, but I heard he left Addis for his homeland not too long ago. But I've seen his work in action on South Africa Street in Addis Ababa and Ghana Road. It's a good thing Addis still has its main boulevards in place, though. Churchill, Tito and Menelik Avenues still remain major arteries for visiting diplomats, relics of a former era.
There's no disputing that Addis and other growing cities need more cartographers like Meiveld. UN Habitat estimates that the urban population of some of Africa's biggest cities are set to triple in the next 40 years. Without a few signs and a cartographic plan, residents, postmen and visiting journalists are bound to get very, very lost. For The Urbanist, I'm Sophie Grove.
That's just about it for this episode of The Urbanist on maps and navigation. But before we go, it's time for this week's tall story. Who better to ask than someone used to using maps in cities and out of them? We ask the entrepreneur and adventurer Justin Packshaw, and he chooses the Grand Harbour in Valletta.
I grew up in Malta, have sailed since I was born, and I defy anyone sailing into that natural harbour early evening or leaving early morning as day starting or ending with a golden light of Valletta to look at these incredible bastions. And it is really quite special. A specific building maybe is St. Paul's Cathedral, which is in Valletta within the bastions of the Grand Harbour, which is a fantastic building, not very old, designed by a guy called William Swamp, where I got married, had my kids christened. Not that I'm particularly religious, but it's a neoclassic building. But in the sort of backdrop of the huge bastions of the Grand Harbour, it's incredibly impressive. The capital of Malta, Valletta, is on a sort of spur, a narrow spur. The street structure of Valletta is very much like Manhattan. It's a grid system. And around this system, around this city, are these enormous walls, bastions, which have the Knights of St. John used Malta as their base for about 300 years. Amazing sort of sieges, the great siege in 1565 with the Turks. And it's all sort of around this very, very austere walls, really, which cascade down into the sea in this natural harbour. But it's all made of sandstone, so it's all made of this beautiful golden sort of yellow stone. So it's not really oppressive. It's actually just very dramatic and very visually breathtaking.
That's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist, all about maps. Tune in next week when we debunk a bunch of urban myths. Remember that you can find out more about all of our shows at monocle.com/24. Today's show was produced by David Michon and edited by Holly Fisher. To hear you out of this episode of The Urbanist, this is Maps by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Pack up, I'm straight. Oh no, oh say, say, say.